our readers are essentially paying us to tell them what's important. So what we can't do is take their money and then say, well, we don't actually know what's important, but we'll just look at what you're clicking on and do more of that. Because, you know, that doesn't really help anyone. You just get more articles about Elon Musk and electric cars, right? Because that's what everyone, or Apple, that's what everyone wants to click on.
Herzlich willkommen bei Weitergedacht, der Podcast der WZ. Jede Woche präsentieren wir eine neue Geschichte, stellen eure Fragen und geben Einblicke in unser 320 Jahre altes Archiv.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen. Mein Name ist Bernd Vasari. Ich bin Redakteur bei der WZ. In der Medienbranche kracht es an allen Ecken und Enden. Papierzeitungen und Magazine werden immer seltener gelesen. Zudem sind Menschen kaum noch bereit, für Online-Inhalte zu zahlen. Der Economist kennt diese Probleme hingegen nur vom Hörensagen. Die Leserschaft konnte in den vergangenen beiden Jahren um 100.000 zahlende Abonnentinnen und Abonnenten gesteigert werden. Wie das funktioniert, welche Fehler Medienhäuser vermeiden sollten und wie eine gute Mischung von jungen und alten Redakteurinnen und Redakteuren gelingen kann, erklärt heute mein Gast, der stellvertretende Chefredakteur des Economist, Tom Standage. Er hat mich nach London in die Redaktion des britischen Wirtschaftsmagazins eingeladen. Hi, Tom.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Thank you for having us. So while many media outlets are struggling with declining readership, The Economist shows no sign of it. Your readership is growing and growing. 2 years ago, you had 1,088,000 subscribers. Today, you have 1,185,000 subscribers. That's nearly 100,000 more in 2 years. What is your secret of success?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think The Economist is quite an unusual publication, so I should probably say that up front, because obviously we are a global publication, so we're based in Britain, but we have people all over the world. And what's even stranger is that most of our readers are in North America, so they're outside the region where we're based. And so we like to think of ourselves as not being, you know, based in a particular place. We don't have a political allegiance to a particular place. We have a particular philosophy that we follow, which is sort of 19th century liberalism, you might say. So I think part of our success has been that, this has been the story for the last 50 years or so, we have attracted readers in North America because we provide a global perspective that is maybe a bit broader than they get from their local media. Now, it has to be said that, you know, both the New York Times and the Washington Post are also pursuing global media strategies. I'm a subscriber to both, even though I live in the UK. And, you know, that's something we've seen many other publications doing in the English speaking world. The Guardian has done the same. It has quite a big operation in Australia now and in the US as well. So, we sort of pioneered that model in retrospect. So I think that's part of it that, you know, for some subscribers, and particularly I think people who are interested in global affairs and global business, that global perspective is something that they've seen more and more value for. And I think we all feel now that, and we saw this with the pandemic, but we see it with globalization, we see it with the internet. Increasingly, you can't just take a national perspective on things. You have to understand how all the things in the world, you know, are interconnected and how things on the other side of the world can affect you. And so I think that has also meant that there has been a growing appetite for the kind of global perspective that we provide. So I think that has helped as well. And then the other thing that we've noticed is that we tend to pick up readers when times are uncertain and when they're difficult. So we you know, have a sort of counter cyclical benefit that when there's a recession, people go, oh no, I don't know what's going to happen. And we saw this during the Trump presidency, that also in many publications saw this, the Trump bump, that the uncertainty that caused and the sort of global implications of what was happening in America meant that there was a lot more interest in a global perspective. And of course, what we've seen in the last few years, in retrospect, the pandemic marked the end of a period of really quite unusual stability. which sort of started to unravel in 2016. But if you look at the first 15 years of this century, and certainly if you look at the last, most of the 2010s, you had this period of relatively little great power conflict because the Cold War had ended. And you had low inflation, you had low interest rates. And, you know, that has actually meant that we had this period of sort of calm and stability, relatively speaking. And that's clearly come to an end. We now have a lot more economic uncertainty. We have a lot more geopolitical uncertainty, not just because of Ukraine, but also because of growing tension between the US and China. And we also have the unpredictable nature of climate change and the extreme weather events. So there are all of these things where suddenly unpredictability is back. And that, I have to, you know, sadly confess, means that more people then generally want to read The Economist. So all of those things added up, probably explain why our circulation continues to grow.
There is a big challenge in media now. The balance is shifting away from print to online. And this development can also be seen in The Economist. 2 years ago, you had 35% of your subscribers that were digital. Today, it's 52%. But this is also interesting in contrast to other newspapers and magazines. You have a paywall, so all your subscribers pay for your online stories. What would you say? Which mistakes did you avoid?
I think that's a good way of putting it. I'd like to say this was all part of a grand strategy, and to some extent it was, but I think it's also the case that we were lucky in some respects, in our approach to digital and our approach to the internet. So yes, the first thing is that for as long as we've had a website, I mean, we had a website quite early in, I think, 95, because we had a couple of editors who were very aware of the internet and it, you know, it was going to come and it was going to be a big deal. And we started reporting on that quite early on. So they set up a website with a few, articles each week, but it really was only, you know, four or five. So when we started putting all of our content on the internet, every week, because at that point we were just a weekly print magazine. And so we had a drop of articles every week. And obviously things have changed a lot since then, but that was when it really began. And our website now, the archive goes back to that year, to 1997. And when we started doing that, we did have a paywall. We always had a paywall, and we've moved the paywall around and we've changed the rules, and we've sometimes, you know, had some bits free and some bits not free, and the number of articles you can read free if you're not a subscriber has gone up and down and all this sort of thing. But to gain full access to The Economist in digital form, you've always had to pay for it. And then when we launched our apps in 2010, that was the case as well. So we've never had to sort of change our position and go back to our readers and say, well, you know how this stuff you've been getting for free, well, now I'm afraid you're going to have to start paying for it. It's always been something that people have had to pay for. So I think a lot of newspapers in the internet boom were chasing advertising revenue, and they were chasing essentially clicks, and that really changes the way you approach journalism. And what that meant was, you know, the more clicks, the better, the more people, the better. And then when the internet advertising started to become, you know, less valuable, they had a problem, and they started to have to put up paywalls, which I think is the right strategy. But that meant that they had been training their readers to expect something to be free for years and years and years. And then they said, actually, it's not free anymore. And that's a difficult transition to go through. And we never had to go through that. We always had a paywall. And also, we've always had quite a high subscription price. I mean, you know, essentially our readers are people who are prepared to pay our subscription price because they feel they get enough value from the publication, that it saves them time and it gives them insights that they can't get elsewhere. And so, so again, we saw some of our rivals, weekly news publications in America in particular, they pursued an advertising-based model. They cut their subscription prices very low. And I'm thinking of magazines like Time and Newsweek here. And so they were chasing very high circulations, and they got to, you know, 3 million or something like that, I think. And of course, they were making most of their money on advertising. And then when print advertising dried up around 2008, 2009, they had a big problem because to pivot to a subscriber-driven model, they had to raise their subscription prices. So it's a bit like the problem with the paywall and the internet. You've trained your readers to expect the publication to be quite low cost, and then raising your prices makes it difficult to hold on to those subscribers. So we never made that mistake. We always had a paywall, and we've always had quite a high subscription price. So that's part of it. The other thing was that we never had a strategy of chasing, you know, an advertising based model. Our main supply of revenue has always been from our readers. And obviously there are times, and I remember during the dot-com boom, because I've been at The Economist for 25 years, but I remember how thick The Economist was then, because there was so much advertising from internet companies and telecoms companies. And we were very, very happy to sell them advertising pages. And while it lasted, you know, we happily took their money, and we were even more profitable than we are without that. But it meant that when that advertising dried up, we still had our revenue from subscribers to sustain us. We didn't have a model that depended on it predominantly on advertising. So in that respect, we were lucky. And then if you look inside, this is a bit more sort of inside baseball for the publishing industry, but what a lot of publications did in the 2000s was they hired a lot of journalists to write articles, to write, create content for digital platforms, for the web, and then subsequently for, you know, for video on Facebook and all this sort of stuff. And that was very often a sort of separate operation from the generally older and more experienced journalists that they had writing for their print editions. And in many news organizations, that created a sort of cultural divide, that the young writers were like, come on, this is the future, we're changing the world. And who are all these dinosaurs over here? And by the way, why are they paid so much more than we are? And then the older journalists saying, who are these whippersnappers? And what is this internet? And it's just getting in the way of my job. And I wish it would just go away. It's just a fad. And, you know, I'll leave the internet to those people, those young people in the corner. They can do the internet. And of course, you know, neither of those positions is right. The internet was the future, and it is part of your job. But it was also not sustainable in the way that those companies very often were approaching it, which was, you know, they were trying to pay the salaries of all of their digital journalists from advertising revenue that then turned out not to be there anymore. So many news organizations then went through this very painful process of having to crunch together two really quite different groups of people. And you know, that again is something that The Economist managed to avoid. Our approach during the dot-com boom was not to hire lots more journalists. In fact, the editor at the time, Bill Emmett, said that the right strategy, because we weren't really sure what was going to happen with internet business models and so on, he said the right strategy is to do the least we can get away with. So we did start publishing some pieces during the week between the Thursdays when our weekly edition comes out, but they were written by the same people who write the weekly. So the idea was that anyone who covers a particular topic, whether it's France or cars or China or, you know, the Brazilian economy, it would be the same person writing for our digital platforms as for our print edition. And that has meant that, you know, because we've increased our output, we have had to hire more people, and the number of journalists has gone steadily up, and the number of foreign bureaus has gone steadily up. But we did that in a very sort of gradual way, and we basically added to our existing newsroom and our existing roster of journalists. We never had a separate team of digital journalists. So again, that was a mistake that I think a lot of publications in retrospect did make and came to regret, and we managed to avoid that one too, and that has also been a good thing. Of course, this is very unhelpful when people come and visit and say, how can we learn from The Economist? What can we do? Well, unless you've got a time machine, you can't avoid that one. And then the kind of being a publication that's based in Britain, but has most of its readers in another part of the world, that's quite difficult for people to copy as well. So it's not like these were great sort of strategic plans that we did. We basically avoided mistakes in some areas, and we were quite lucky in others. And I think the main thing that we did that was a deliberate choice was to never make all of our content free.
This is very interesting, because many newspapers and magazines fetch young employees only for the online sections. The older employees only take care of print. So there's a culture clash then. But how do you do it? In which areas do you deploy young employees? How does it work if a young employee comes to The Economist?
So it's always been the case that, I started on the science desk, which is one of the places where people start. And the great thing about science is you have to write about all sorts of different subjects, and you end up not just writing for the science pages, but when there's sort of a science, policy debate, or there's something like the pandemic, that became a science story that touched everything else. So it means that you naturally sort of end up working with other departments. And then when it's time to move on, you move on into one of those departments. So I specialized in science, but also the sort of hard end of science, physics and microchips and that sort of thing. So I ended up writing about tech on the business section next. That's where I went into business, but other people go in other directions. We also quite often start people on the Britain section and in the finance pages. And then we have a whole load of digital roles like the social media department, the films department, and they are producing digital content. But very often what happens is that the people working on those departments, they're not, part of the core journalism team in the sense that they're writing for the weekly, but very often, or indeed for the website, but very often the smart ones do start pitching articles. They do start, they start writing explainers, and they start writing daily charts, and then they start writing the longer pieces for other sections. And that's how they then move on. So there are those particular departments where people tend to start. We also have quite a long tradition of internships. And furthermore, they're paid internships, and they're paid quite well, because living in London, where many of these internships happen, also in New York and Washington, is expensive. And so we don't want it to be the case that, only people who already have somewhere to live can apply for these internships. And that is also a very common source of new talent for us, that people who are interns, they may not be hired immediately, but they are very often subsequently hired. And so that means that we have lots of, plenty of young people coming in and going straight into the sort of core journalistic operation, rather than saying you have to do 10 years writing for the website, and then if you're lucky, we'll give you a job on the print edition, which, might have been a thing that newspapers would have said a few years ago. But I think, that wouldn't be a terribly appealing prospect these days, because print editions are going away. And I think the sort of prestige of print, which has been there for a long time, I think people are paying less attention to that. We certainly are paying less attention to that. Obviously we want our print edition to be what it's always been, the sort of desert island read. If there's only one publication that's dropped from an airplane, you can read it and you can understand what's happening in the world. That's always been the aspiration. But we are spreading out the publication of what we put in the weekly edition. We're spreading that out throughout the week. So you can consume the weekly as a digital product once a week. It comes out on Thursday and it's got a cover, and you can do all that. But you can also read, if you go to the home tab of our app, or the homepage of our website, you can read some of those pieces, a few days earlier. And we have a constant stream of other material coming out on our digital platforms. And what we're seeing is that more and more of our subscriber base are reading us on a sort of more of a daily basis than a weekly basis. The style of our journalism is still not to switch to being a daily newspaper. We are still not, specialists in jumping on daily news stories. There are lots and lots of other newspapers and news organizations that do that. It's really it's the analysis. It's the global perspective. It's a slightly step back from what's happening and tell you what it means approach. And that's something we can deliver, more than once a week. I mean, we can deliver that on a daily basis, but I think that's what people really value from us, not what's happened, but this thing has happened. What does it mean? And that's really where we differentiate ourselves. And that's not really, all of that stuff I've just said, that is independent of the medium where you deliver the journalism. You can do that in print. You can do that in digital platforms. Ultimately, what our readers are doing is they're paying us to help them understand the world. And we used to do that through a print publication, and we can now do that through, a range of digital platforms and print as well. So I think our business model still works if print goes away. That said, I think a lot of our readers do still like print. So I think we do have quite a high cover price. So I think we're likely to be one of the last digital publications, one of the last print publications still standing, along with the glossy fashion magazines and architectural magazines, those things that look really, really nice on your coffee table. But I think we'll be one of the last ones standing, because our model is essentially not dependent on the way in which you read us. or consumers.
So what, if I understood correctly, of course you had a weekly cycle with the print magazine, and now with online you have a daily cycle. What do you do with breaking news? How important are breaking news?
So we sort of have both. So yes, rather than thinking about it as print and digital, we think about it as weekly and daily. So there are a bunch of things that happen on a weekly cycle, like designing the cover, and then those weekly cycle things happen to be the things that go into the print edition, but they also go into the digital version of the weekly edition. And then we have a bunch of daily cycle things that happen. So we have, you know, a set of daily newspaper newsletters. We have a daily news service called Spresso, which is a daily app. And then we also, for some of the material that's going into the weekly, you know, if it's an article about, I don't know, there's a summit on a Tuesday, it makes much more sense to publish that on the Tuesday or indeed on the Monday and tell you what we think is going to happen, rather than, you know, saying what actually happened afterwards on the Thursday. So very often we'll have a story that, that responds to news or anticipates news, and then a version of that story suitably updated will appear in the weekly. So what it means is that the sort of what we used to have of, you know, the number of new items published on digital platforms used to have this big lump on Thursdays, and that lump has been gradually smoothed out now. There's still a little bit of a lump, but it's much smaller than it was. I think it's about a third of, a third of items, appear for the first time on the Thursday that are in the weekly. So in other words, two thirds of the stuff in the weekly has already been published, by then. It's something like that now. It's been changing quite rapidly in the last couple of years. But what that means is that, it is more likely that, you know, we're telling you about stuff that's relevant today. It still all works as a weekly publication if you'd like to consume it that way. And we are essentially meeting our readers where they want to be. If they want to consume it weekly, they can. And if they want to, if they want it sort of spread out throughout the week, because, you know, there's quite a lot to read, then, they can do it that way too.
So you don't do breaking news?
Not really. No, we only do it if we think we can add something. So I'm reminded of something like the Bataclan attack in Paris a few years ago. And that took place on a Friday. So we, you know, the weekly edition had gone to bed, but obviously it was a big deal. And we did put up a story that evening saying there's been this attack and all the rest of it. But of course, everyone else did too. And what we found, that it was a quite eye-opening moment, I think, for many of our journalists, because, you know, it was one of the first times we had coordinated coverage on Slack. So we'd recently started using Slack, and, you know, that day, the editor who was in charge of the coverage said, we're not going to use email for this because there's just too many email threads. If you're not on Slack, get on Slack now. So everybody got on Slack. So that was an eye-opening thing. But the other thing was that, one of our correspondents then wrote an analysis piece about what this terrorist attack in Paris meant for French foreign policy, for French, you know, for the French government's approach to migrants and to Islam and all this sort of thing. And that piece did much, much better than our news piece. You know, the number of people who came and read that on our website on the Saturday was much, much higher.
Sorry, it was 1 or 2 days after.
It was the Saturday. So the attack was on a Friday night. Mm-hmm. We published that piece, just before lunch, as I recall, on Saturday. And, you know, the top of the website. And that was the piece that, you know, got a lot more, interest, and a lot more people read it. And that was because everybody had done the basic story of, you know, this is what happened, and this is how many people died, and this is what went wrong, and this is how the police responded, and all the rest of it. But what this meant for France in the coming months and years was, that's exactly the kind of thing that we specialize in. We can do it. We don't need a whole week to think about that. So we can respond to that. You could say that's a breaking news story. I mean, it was the next day, but what we weren't doing, we weren't like updating. We didn't have a live blog with, you know, this many ambulances have arrived and all this sort of thing, because there are lots of other news organizations that do that and do it very well. And
sorry, Andrew, do you have only one article about the event and that's it?
Yeah, probably. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, in that case, we had one. I mean, it happened. And then we had a what does this mean piece. In other cases, you know, obviously you do need to have multiple pieces. With something like the pandemic or the war in Ukraine, it's a rolling story. And so you have to approach that differently. But I mean, something like the war, you know, that's been a good example of how being able to provide analysis, but being able to provide it in response to the news quickly. So what does the destruction of that dam in Ukraine mean? And all this sort of thing. That is exactly the sort of thing, that we do. And that seems to be exactly what people value, because you could spend hours reading through all of the, you know, live blogging of this has happened and that's happened. And here's a video from Twitter of something blowing up and all the rest of it. But if you actually just want to know what's happened today and what does it mean? And you want to do that once a day, then, you know, we can help you with that. Come to our website or look on our app once a day and we can tell you. And so, so we've heard this from many people that, you know, with something like the war, following that without spending your whole time refreshing Twitter or reloading, newspaper live blogs, if you just want to stay up to date, but not spend too long doing it, then that's the sort of thing that, you know, that we can help you with.
What would you say? How much time do you have for a story, or how slow is possible?
What do you mean by how slow?
There's the event like, in Bataclan on Friday. And then the next piece, the piece from The Economist was on Saturday. So this is one day.
Yes. So yes, we got a piece up, you know, within a couple of hours, I think, which is not very fast by, you know, the standards of Reuters or whatever. But yes, we got a basic piece up. And I think we probably updated it a couple of times, but we quickly realized that just constantly adding updates to it, that, and it was a really good example of that. That was just, you know, there was no point in doing that. People were not coming to us for, the latest updates on the death toll or whatever. And, and so I think we added an editor's note at the top, you know, update, the death toll has now risen to this, you know, now that the, you know, the building has been stormed or whatever. So, so we didn't, we sort of press pause or press stop on continuing to update the story, because that's not where we can add the most value. So yeah, generally if there's big news, and we haven't got something prepared, then, you know, we will think that getting something up in 3 or 4 hours is acceptable, usually because there will be, it won't just be a straight news piece. There will be some analysis in there as well. And then very often the amount of analysis will go up in the piece that finally ends up in the weekly, or we may publish subsequent, analysis pieces. So, we're really not trying to compete with the news wires. And, you know, I know that, you know, other news organizations, they, how quickly you get your news alert out, your push alert, and how many clicks you can get people. So, you know, that we're not really playing that game.
Mm-hmm. How long is the life cycle of an article, or how long does it stay on the homepage?
That's a very good question. There isn't a fixed answer. If something, I mean, most pieces that run in the weekly, and there are something like probably 60 or 70 pieces in the weekly, maybe a bit more than that, but certainly less than 100. Most pieces will get some sort of appearance on the homepage, but so they may only be there for half a day. But what we find is that pieces that, you know, are particularly popular or do particularly well can stay there for a lot longer. And so, you know, occasionally we will have pieces, we've had many pieces like this with the war in Ukraine, where people are particularly interested in reading about, you know, the state of the Russian army or whatever. And so those pieces, you know, if people are still interested in them, we'll leave them up. So in that respect, we are paying attention to what our audience is doing. We're not taking, our audience's behavior as a signal about what we should write more about, because one of the things that's happening is that our readers are essentially paying us to tell them what's important. So what we can't do is take their money and then say, well, we don't actually know what's important, but we'll just look at what you're clicking on and do more of that. Because, you know, that doesn't really help anyone. You just get more articles about Elon Musk and electric cars, right? Because that's what everyone, or Apple, that's what everyone wants to click on. And if we say, well, actually, we need to be paying attention to, you know, what's happening in Venezuela or whatever, that's a useful service we provide to our readers, which is to alert them to things that they didn't know they needed to know about, or they didn't know they would find interesting. So we don't use analytics to decide what to write about, but we do use analytics to decide decide what to feature and what to promote. So what do we put in our newsletters? You know, what do we put on social media or re-promote on social media? What do we put on the homepage or keep on the homepage for longer? And that is interesting to see. Oh, this seems to be working well. People seem to be interested in that. But we don't then say, right, let's go and do loads more pieces like that so that we gather more clicks, because ultimately, you know, that's not our model. Our model is a subscription based model. And so we need to be, you know, aware of what our readers are finding interesting, and it can be, and help other readers find those pieces. But it doesn't change what we actually write about.
Unsere Hörerinnen und Hörer haben die Möglichkeit, Fragen zu unseren Podcast-Folgen zu stellen. Diese hat uns die 22-jährige Katharina aus Graz geschickt.
Ich finde es voll wichtig, meine Meinung sagen zu können. Beim Economist gibt es aber unter den Artikeln keine Kommentarfunktion. Warum ist das eigentlich so und wie haltet ihr mit euren Leserinnen und Lesern Kontakt?
Well, that's so, because when it comes to readers, that you don't have a commentary section.
So what do you mean by a commentary? Oh, we don't have comments at the bottom.
Yeah.
Yes.
You don't have?
No. Well, I mean, a lot of, we did for a while, for quite a long while, and you know, many publications have switched off their comment sections. And it's for a variety of reasons. In our case, it was partly technical. We were having a great deal of difficulty, preventing spam, comments, basically. And it was just becoming more and more technically difficult to stop them, because the system that we were using under the hood is quite antiquated. And we're in fact still in the process of turning it off. But it meant that, investing to prevent spam comments, meant investing in an old platform that we wanted to turn off. So I have to confess that was part of the reason. But the other reason, I think, generally was that there's been a broader shift away from allowing commenting, just because it can be so toxic. It can expose you to legal risk. And I think the approach that many publications take now, which I have a lot of respect for, and I would be very happy to see us adopt in future, once it's technically possible, is to allow comments on some articles. And so you see this with the New York Times. They switch on, comments on certain articles. And then that way you can really concentrate your moderating resources on those pieces and make sure you get a really high level discussion. And you know, some of the other things the New York Times does as well, where they invite comments by email and then they publish a selection of. So I think there are good ways of doing this. The other thing that happened, of course, is that a lot of that discussion moved onto social media platforms. And so, you know, expecting people to discuss the article on your website, when in fact they were going to be talking about it, on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, started to look a bit behind the time. So I think the sort of heyday of the comment section from sort of 2008 to 2013 or 14 or something is probably, yes, I can't remember when we switched ours off, but I think that was a sort of a period in internet history where things worked in a particular way, and things have moved on. But I think, yeah, there are good ways to do comments, and to have discussions, but you really do have to, you have to moderate them carefully. And also if a discussion starts off, with a good polite tone and, high degree of sort of, in particular, if you get journalists themselves to weigh in early in a discussion, many people have found that really improves the quality of the subsequent discussion. So there are these ways to ensure that you can get a useful, informative discussion. The problem is they don't scale. You can't do them on every single article. So I think deciding where to do them is a way to do it. And we have other ways of having discussions with our subscribers now as well. We do a weekly subscriber webinar, which is only for subscribers, where a group of editors talks about something in the news that week, and we take questions from the subscribers as well. And that's proving very popular. So I think, you know, being able to discuss things with your audience is useful, but how you do that is constantly evolving.
Mm-hmm. We talked about that media is changing from print to online. How does that change your workflow? Which factors decide if a story is a video, text, podcast, or will be published in print?
Well, there isn't a single answer to that. So we do have an audio. We make several podcasts. So we have a daily podcast called The Intelligence, and then we have several weekly podcasts as well. And we also do podcast series on the side. And so in those cases, the producers of those podcasts are working closely with the newsroom to not just do, you know, discussions about articles we've published, but very often to preempt those articles. If there's news on a particular day, yes, we'll cover it, but we'll also discuss it in a podcast. Films is, you know, is a bit, video is a bit harder because the turnaround time is, for the sorts of video we make is not quite as quick as it is for audio. And then we have the audio edition, which is the audio versions of all of our articles in the weekly, and they're read out by actual humans, by retired newsreaders for the most part. And that's a very popular feature for us. But yes, I mean, there is this broader question of how do all of those different media types fit together? And like everybody else, we're continuing to experiment. I think we've got, you know, we've figured out what our voice sounds like in podcasts, and we've figured out what it sounds like in video. But at the end of the day, I think written journalism is still central to what we do, because going back, and I keep saying this, you know, the deal we have with our readers is roughly they pay us money to save them time, to figure out what's important this week and what they should make of it. And the quickest way to absorb a lot of information about a complex subject is still to read words on a page or on a screen. And, you know, in theory, video gives you much higher bandwidth, but in practice, actually absorbing information quickly is, it's best done just by reading. Now that could change, and we could have brain implants in the future, or I don't know what, in which case we would have to, you know, adapt the way we deliver our journalism. And we already deliver it in lots of different ways on lots of different platforms. So, you know, we think that what we provide, which is the expertise of our journalists, will still work on other platforms that emerge. But at the moment, the best way to deliver on our promise, which is we have busy readers, busy subscribers who want to know what's going on, they want to understand the world, and they don't have much time, we think that reading is still the main way to do that. And yes, you can supplement that with audio and video and other things, and interactive graphics and so on as well. But at the end of the day, that's still the centerpiece of our output.
How do you do it? Is all online articles go in print, or all print articles go online?
All print articles go online, and then there are additional online-only things like a daily chart, like explainers, like additional news updates in between. Sometimes you'll get an early version of a story or a news version of story runs on digital platforms, and then an updated version of it appears in print. Or other times, mm-hmm. a print story will run online, and then we'll update that. But we tend not to update stories because, you know, where do you stop doing it? And then obviously all of our audio and video output is digital only. So so yes, everything you see in print runs online, but not everything you see online will necessarily have appeared or will appear in print.
Was haben wir zum Thema Medien in unserem Archiv gefunden? In Österreich wurde 1867 mit dem Staatsgrundgesetz die Pressefreiheit eingeführt. Die Wiener Zeitung druckte das Gesetz am 22. Dezember 1867 auf ihrer Titelseite ab. Unter Artikel 13 steht: Jedermann hat das Recht, durch Wort, Schrift, Druck oder durch bildliche Darstellung seine Meinung innerhalb der gesetzlichen Schranken frei zu äußern. Die Presse darf weder unter Zensur gestellt noch durch das Konzessionssystem beschränkt werden.
What do you think when you look in the future, in the next 5 years? So what I asked, what we're talking about in the beginning, that many media outlets are struggling now. Will people continue to read newspapers, or what will be the future of media?
Well, I've been saying for quite a long time that I thought that the business model of news, digital only news organizations that were sustained entirely by advertising, was very precarious. And I didn't think there was a good long-term future there. And just in the past few months, we've seen, you know, Vice has gone bankrupt. BuzzFeed has shut down its news organizations. I should say, you know, I've been making this prediction for a long time. I wish this wasn't true. Both Vice and BuzzFeed News did really excellent journalism. And, you know, but the problem is that, just relying on digital ads is not enough to fund a newsroom. And that's difficult. And the other thing is that they tried various other models like video and so on. Ultimately, when you've got big technology platforms that sit between you and the readers, whether that's Google search engine or Facebook or Twitter's algorithm, then you are in a precarious position because changes to those algorithms can really affect your business model. And so, so what we've been saying for a long time, and this has been our model, and we're seeing more and more news organizations move to this model, is that when you have a subscription-based model and people pay you directly for the journalism and you deliver it directly to them through your website and through your app, and there is nobody else in the middle, we think that is a much more sustainable model. Now, the problem with that is that, not everybody can afford to subscribe to all of these publications. And so what do you do about that? And, so I think there's a place for public service broadcasting. That's part of it. And I think there's also, you know, there are some other interesting models. If you look at what The Guardian has done, for example, I subscribe to The Guardian. So I pay to read The Guardian. I used to work at The Guardian. It's a, you know, it's a great British journalistic institution that I want to survive. But its business model for many years has been that everything on its website is free. And, you know, therefore they were dependent on advertising. They found this middle way where they basically make subscribing optional. So you can choose to pay them if you want, and you get some, you know, you get improved access through their app and this sort of thing. And they also had a kind of, you know, donation tip jar where you could just make a contribution to the Guardian. I was quite skeptical that would work, but it has worked. That so I think there may be some other models that we need to explore, but I think the long and short of it is that an entirely advertising based model is extremely precarious, and so I expect to see less of that. And I expect to see more emphasis, even more emphasis than we've seen on subscription models. And then the other model that we've seen more of lately is the philanthropically supported news organization. So something like ProPublica, where essentially you've got philanthropy supporting investigative journalism. And I think it's good that we've seen that, and we've seen, you know, some of the big foundations and tech entrepreneurs investing in separately in journalism because it's something they want to see survive. So I think, again, we're going to see more of that, more people basically stepping up to fund journalism, which is otherwise not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Tom, thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you.
Okay, have a nice day.
You too.
Heute waren wir zu Gast beim britischen Wirtschaftsmagazin Economist in London. Wir haben erfahren, warum Breaking News nicht immer zu Erfolg führen, welche Geschichten gerne gelesen werden und wie lange es noch Zeitungen geben wird. Ich bedanke mich fürs Zuhören. Bis zum nächsten Mal.
Das war die heutige Folge von Weitergedacht, der Podcast der WZ. Wenn euch das gefallen hat, abonniert diesen Podcast, folgt uns auf Instagram und TikTok und schaut auf unserer Website wz.at vorbei. Habt ihr Fragen oder Vorschläge für unsere nächsten Folgen? Dann schickt uns eine Sprachnachricht über WhatsApp. Unsere Nummer lautet 0664 834 8344. Missing Link.